studying tonight in Daniel chapter 5. Why don't you join me there? We're beginning, of course, with the beginning of chapter 5, a new section in Daniel. And the chronology of the story of Daniel's life and how the Lord worked in and through Daniel. We're fast-forwarding now. The first four chapters have been focused on the story of these three, actually four young men, including Daniel and his three companions, who have been, among others, in the nation of Israel, captured by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, as the Babylonians invaded Israel. Judah, actually the southern kingdom, to be technically correct, conquered it and carried away the survivors into captivity back in the land of Babylon. Most of the young men that were captured and brought to the king's court ended up just blending in with Babylonian culture and lost their true spiritual identity as those that had special covenant relationship with the Lord. But these four young men remained true to the Lord in spite of their extreme circumstances. I mean, can you imagine? Some nation greater and more powerful than us comes in, conquers us as a nation, and enslaves us and takes us into a land. We lose our home, we lose our jobs, we lose all of our familiar surroundings, takes us into captivity into that foreign land to serve the purposes of the head of that government. That was their circumstance. And yet those first four chapters, you know, are a wonderful testimony of how God powerfully worked in the hearts of these four young men to preserve their spiritual integrity and to make them a testimony to the honor and glory of the Lord. Most of the story revolves around a series of interactions between them and the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, and the ways that the Lord chose to communicate with this king. Four times we've seen the Lord spoke both through circumstance and through direct message to King Nebuchadnezzar, each one penetrating his heart in the first three instances, but not really changing his heart. But finally, in the fourth message, the message of the tree dream that we studied in chapter 4 and the aftermath, which was the Lord's judgment upon him, bringing to pass what he saw in the dream and taking Nebuchadnezzar through a seven-year period in which he literally lost his mind and lived like a beast in the earth. And at the end of that time, by the grace of God and according to God's purpose for him, the Lord restored him to his right mind, restored him to his kingdom, and actually, I believe, saved Nebuchadnezzar and made him his servant and caused him to reach out to the entire world through a special message that we saw at the beginning of chapter 4, a message that we would call an evangelistic message sent throughout the known world at that time. Now Nebuchadnezzar's dead, and the story moves on. Daniel, however, has survived him. Daniel has outlived Nebuchadnezzar. And now we come to a later period of time, probably around 23 to 25 years after Nebuchadnezzar's story ends. We pick up in chapter 5. Between the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5, there's no additional information. So that gap of time in between, we're going to have to fill in the blanks as we go, and we will get back to what was developing between those two moments at the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5. But Nebuchadnezzar, as I said, he's died, and now the kingdom of Babylon continues on under new leadership, and we're introduced to a new character here at the beginning of chapter 5, and that is King Belshazzar. Now, I want to describe to you something about King Belshazzar up front. This is an interesting side note, and I'm going to describe all this before we read the text tonight. We're going to study the first 17 verses tonight, the first half approximately of the chapter. It's an interesting side note of archaeology, and I think not an unimportant one, a significant one. There was a time, back 100 years ago or so, when those who studied the Bible but struggled to actually believe it, struggled to trust it, believed in many cases like some foolish Bible scholars do at times, thinking that they were more wise than the scriptures that they were studying, they would come to this story about King Belshazzar, and they would point to this as an example of how the Bible cannot be entirely trusted and how the Bible is not entirely historically accurate. The reason they would point to this story in particular is because at that time, this name, King Belshazzar, could be found nowhere in any historical records or any archaeological findings. The way we saw history was we went chronologically from Nebuchadnezzar and then between Nebuchadnezzar and the last king of Babylon, a man who's not mentioned in Scripture, but his name is Nabonidus, and he is historically verified as the last king of Babylon. Well, from Nebuchadnezzar, this story that we're about to read seems to indicate that the next king that follows him is Belshazzar. But the historical record, and this historical record is a verified one, and it's an accurate one, the historical record indicates that there was another king by a different name that's named elsewhere in Scripture that followed Nebuchadnezzar. Following him was a second king. Following him was the third king. All of these, you know, lived as kings of Babylon for a relatively short period of time. Nebuchadnezzar ruled Babylon for an extended period of time, over 40 years. But the three that followed him all lived and served as kings. They ruled as kings for a relatively short period of time. Then these three kings were replaced by the last king of Babylon, Nabonidus. Nabonidus was then conquered by the Persians. We're going to be introduced to the Persians in the chapters that follow in the book of Daniel. Remember, in our study of the first dream message that Nebuchadnezzar received from the Lord back in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar saw this image, this gigantic statue. It was a single great statue that represented the chronology of the great dominating world empires, starting at that time in history with Babylon and extending in the successive world empires that were to follow. And the statue was composed of four different sections with four different elements or metals representing those four different empires. The first and greatest being gold, which was the head, which corresponded to Nebuchadnezzar and the Empire of Babylon. And the Persians, we identified in our study back in chapter 2, were represented by the second section, the silver chest and arms and shoulders section of the statue, which was actually the Medes and the Persians in a combined dual empire, which is why it corresponds to the two arms of the statue. So the question that scholars of a prior generation had was that they read the historical record and they saw Nebuchadnezzar and they saw Nabonidus and they saw the three kings in between the two, but nowhere to be found was Belshazzar in history, in archaeology. And so they drew a quick conclusion and a wrong one, foolish one, and they said, therefore, the Bible's not true. Or at least some portions of it are not true. We can't trust all of it, at least as a historical record. Well, people who have made those conclusions have time and time and time and time and time again been proven wrong by later discoveries of archaeology. Archaeology has never yet disproven any of the historical facts of the Bible. It's only later validated exactly what was described in the text of Scripture itself. So while Belshazzar didn't appear in any of the early findings in all of the archaeological digs in the area of Babylon, later discoveries found 37 distinct mentions of Belshazzar as ruler of Babylon following Nebuchadnezzar. However, the archaeological discoveries and the historical record that was developed from those discoveries did not show that he was the immediate successor to Nebuchadnezzar. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't immediately followed, the very next king being Belshazzar, but these three intervening kings, their names are not important for our study tonight, did come between Nebuchadnezzar and this man, who's not mentioned in Scripture, as I mentioned earlier, Nabonidus, but his son, Nabonidus' son, is and was Belshazzar. And Nabonidus was he was kind of a strange king. He had a, as we've studied before, the Babylonians had these false gods that they worshipped. And there were certain gods that were socially and politically acceptable to be emphasized, and certain ones that were acknowledged by the Babylonians, but it wasn't socially and politically expedient to focus your main attention on those gods. Nabonidus was devoted to the moon god, which was not the main god over Babylon, wasn't even the secondary god over Babylon. It was like a lower tier god. And he got into a lot of political trouble for his great devotion to this moon god. And so at a certain point, what he decided to do is he decided to move out of the capital city of Babylon altogether, because he was always in trouble with all of the people of his kingdom for this devotion that he had to this one god. And he, you know, was devoted to this one false god to the exclusion of all others. And so he moved some 500 miles south of Babylon and set up a second capital city at the very tail end of the Babylonian Empire. And he ruled over this southern city quite content down there, because the people in that area did worship the moon god. It was modern-day Saudi Arabia. And that's the area, of course, where the whole Muslim thing found its origin, which, for those who don't understand and have never studied this, the worship of the moon god was at the core and the heart of Islam, which is why in their symbol that's chosen, you see a half-moon symbol. So anyway, Nabonidus was down south, and of course Babylon was continuing on business as normal in the north, and what he did was he made his son, Belshazzar, co-regent, which means basically, you are king with me. I'm the number one king, and I'll be ruling down south where it's just, I don't have to deal with all the trouble, the religious controversy, and I will leave you in Babylon, and you will be number two king in Babylon for the duration of our rule. Okay? So, let's read the text. I don't want to lose you with all that historical detail, but it's not insignificant if you ever run across some account that says, well, you know, Belshazzar, you know, because one of the things that's mentioned in this text that we're about to read is that Belshazzar was... what the father of Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar, okay? And I'm telling you that the father of Belshazzar was actually Nabonidus. There's a couple of different ways to understand this. Just before we read the text, let me get this out of the way also. One is Belshazzar's father is Nebuchadnezzar in a political sense, in that he is the predecessor. It was very common in the rule of ancient empires to refer to your predecessor as your father. And so technically, he could have been his father just in a political sense. But the other possibility is this. There are a lot of indications, and there's no confirmation of this, but there's a lot of indications that what happened was when Nabonidus took office, that he married one of the daughters of Nebuchadnezzar, and that their son that was produced was Belshazzar. And so Belshazzar, in that sense, would be the grandson of King Nebuchadnezzar. But in those days, they didn't have a term for grandfather, so he would be referred to as his father. So it's in that sense that I'm going to take the understanding that we're going to read when we read these 17 verses this, tonight, that the father of Belshazzar is Nebuchadnezzar. All right, so let's read from verse 1 of chapter 5. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives, his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods was found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, and we'll end right at that point. We're going to end actually in verse, I said 17, but we're going to end in 16 tonight. I want to save Daniel's response for the beginning of our study next time. All right. We've got here a special event in the life of King Belshazzar. And it's interesting, this is the only event in Scripture in his life that's actually described for us. And it's, of course, a political event. It's a social event. It's a great party that he's throwing. But it has a political purpose, a social purpose. It has a very important purpose in his plans for his own kingdom. What is not told in the backstory of what's going on this night is that Babylon has just been defeated in a great battle by the Persian army. In fact, his father, Nabonidus, who is ruling in the south, went out to war against the Persians and was crushed in battle. And he is on the verge of being killed, his father down south. And now what's happened for the king in the north, the co-regent, is that he is held up now in the city of Babylon. He's basically in a circumstance like a turtle when it's under attack. What does a turtle do when it's under attack? It retreats into its shell because it believes it's safe from all attacks, and it usually is safe from most attacks. And the shell that Belshazzar has retreated into is the walls of the city of Babylon. We briefly described these, but the walls of the city of Babylon were gigantic. They were thick. They were mighty. They were powerful. They were literally thick enough that two chariots could run side by side along the tops of the city walls. And this was not just a fortified city. There was the river Euphrates that watered it. There was a river that ran literally under the city walls to keep the city refreshed with fresh water. And the king had stored, by best estimates, 20 years of food in the city. In case anyone ever laid siege against the city, he would just retreat in behind the walls of the city, feeling like, you know, I've got water, I've got food, no one can get through these walls, I am safe and sound. What he wasn't anticipating and planning was that later this very night, what is going to happen, and this part of the story isn't detailed for us in the text, but this is what happened historically. The Persians dammed up the Euphrates River that was running under the walls of the city. And when they dammed up the river, it caused a gap so that they were able to march underneath the walls of the city, enter the city, and conquer it. And they killed this king, Belshazzar, that night, and he lost his kingdom at the end of this night. But right now, at the beginning of chapter 5, he's not anticipating that's going to happen. He is confidently sitting there in the midst of his city, even though his father has just lost this tremendous battle to the Persians, and it seems to be a moment of great defeat. He throws a party, a celebration, a feast. And why would you do that? One is probably because he wants to make himself known as the king. His father has just been defeated, so he's going to put himself in the position as king. And number two is, of course, this is going to give confidence to all the inhabitants of the city. They've just heard news of this great defeat for the Babylonian Empire. It's the first time the Babylonians have been defeated in battle ever in history up until this moment. And so he wants to encourage the hearts of the people. What better way to do that than to throw this giant celebration to indicate, you know, I'm confident, I have nothing to worry about as king over Babylon. So he throws this great feast. And the feast is in particular for his lords. These are the higher-ups in the governing authorities of Babylon. And the feast is gigantic. He invites 1,000 of his government officials. And what they do is, it says he drinks wine in front of the 1,000. Now, this is a small detail, but it's not insignificant either. What's going on here is normally, when a king would in the ancient world would throw a feast like this, he would actually have his own feast in a separate private room. He would have all his guests out into the main hallway, the main area, but he would feast with his inner circle in private, where he would be safe. Here he comes out and he holds the feast in public. He does it in such a way that he is demonstrating his confidence in his own kingdom, and he intentionally drinks wine in front of the 1,000 lords that he has invited to be with him. And it goes on to describe, of course, that as he was drinking, and not just himself, but his lords, his wives were all with him, his concubines were with him, everyone was drinking together. And it says that he commanded in verse 2 that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought. And his intention in having them brought, we can look back just for a moment. Keep your place in chapter 5. Look back just for a moment in chapter 1 of Daniel. just to get the reference here to what's going on in contrast. In chapter 1 of verse 1, the very beginning of the book, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, that's the land of Babylon, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Now that's the last time, this was nearly 50 years prior to what we're reading now in chapter 5, that's the last time we hear anything about these vessels. Now what vessels are we talking about? It says the vessels that were taken out of the temple of God in Jerusalem. What we're talking about is all of the various serving utensils, all of the things that were used, the various furnishings of the temple, including cups, including plates, including the lampstand, including various items of furniture, the table of showbread itself, all of those things. Remember, when the king of Babylon conquered Judah, when he conquered Jerusalem, when he conquered the temple in Jerusalem, he ransacked it. He took everything of value out of the temple as spoils of war, and he brought it back to Babylon, and he put it as a kind of a symbol of his dominance in the treasury of the God that he worshipped. It was a symbol that my God is greater than the God that this temple was dedicated to in Jerusalem. But those vessels have been there all this time. These were all of the cups, for instance, that the priesthood in Jerusalem drank from when they served in their various rounds of service in the temple in Jerusalem. Gold and silver utensils and vessels. And so now, back in chapter 5, what's happening is some nearly 50 years later, Belshazzar remembers these vessels that have been stored in this temple in Babylon, and he commands for his servants to go and get those temples and brings them to the feast. And he doesn't just put them on display to say, look, I want you guys to be confident that we're able to defeat the nations around us. Look at all of the great victories we've had in times past, and I'm displaying some of the spoils of our war. It's not that alone. He has the vessels then distributed to all of the guests at his great party. And they fill them. He commands those vessels to be filled with wine. And then all of the guests in his party drink from those vessels. What's the problem here? What's the issue? These are vessels, of course, that the Lord had commanded back in the law of Moses, the law of God, that were to be constructed and used in the temple and only the temple. And even then, it wasn't just average use. These were vessels that were only to be handled by, who would you imagine? The Levites, the priests, those that had been set apart by God for special service to the Lord in the tabernacle and the temple. And only they were qualified to handle these, to use these vessels. And so these were symbols of the service of God for special holy purposes. And now these were being taken and made to serve in a very unholy purpose for the honor and glory of this king, Belshazzar, no longer for the honor and glory of the Lord. The reason this detail is given to us at the beginning of the story and later when Daniel begins to, you know, he eventually calls for Daniel after his own wise men are unable to explain to him the message that was written on the wall. And Daniel comes in, and Daniel, we're going to see next week, is going to describe for him why this message has been written on the wall of his palace and what it means. And one of the things Daniel is going to mention is, you took these vessels that belong to the Lord, you filled them with wine, you gave them to your party goers, and you all got drunk using these vessels that were meant only for holy service. In other words, the Lord doesn't take this kind of misuse of his things lightly. And so this is going to be an issue as the rest of the events of this night unfold. All right, so the vessels are misused. And it says, as they were drinking from the vessels of God, they began to say something. And it wasn't just one person in the party. It was everyone together in unison began to say something. What were they saying? Anyone? They began to praise the gods, and of course this is gods with a little g, the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Now, the first four should be familiar to us, especially in the particular sequence that they're mentioned here. The first four are four sections of the great image that God had communicated to King Nebuchadnezzar about in the spiritual dream message that he had given him back in chapter 2. Gold, silver, bronze, and iron in that exact order. Then wood and stone are added to that because, of course, the idols is what they're really praising. The idols that they have made to worship, they have called, these are our gods. We're giving credit to these things we have made. They were made of these six substances, gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, constructed of various natural elements. So they began to not just violate the holy vessels of God, but they began to violate the name and the honor of God by praising the false gods that they worshipped. And then something very unusual, something unexpected. It wasn't like the entertainment for the evening in the party that the king had planned. It wasn't like, after the wine, I've got a magician scheduled to entertain us. But there is something magical that happens next. And it says in the text that immediately is connected to, it's obviously a time clue. It's connected to these two events that have just taken place. The misuse of the holy vessels and the praise of the false gods. And immediately after these two things take place, what happens is, and the description is very interesting to me, the fingers of a human hand appeared. And from the description, it's possible that what was seen was a full hand from the wrist down, because there is an indication of the palm and fingers in connection to each other. But no more than that. Just like if you were to spiritually cut my hand off of my arm and all you could see now floating in the air was my hand. And writing on the wall of this feast room in the palace, and by the way, archaeology has discovered that exact room. And that room, still in the find that archaeologists have discovered, was coated. The walls of the room were coated with a bright white plaster. And so writing like on a white background so that it was clear and obvious for anyone to see, this mysterious, apparently disembodied, floating hand begins to write a message on the wall. Now, we're going to save the meaning of the message for our study next week, but what is written is this: many, many, tekel, parson. And of course, the king notices what's going on. He sees this taking place. It's done in such a way and in such a location in the room that the king can't avoid but to see it. It says, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. Now, why is that detail given to us? All right. And by the way, what lampstand are we talking about here? The likelihood is, and this is what I believe is indicated here, this lampstand that is opposite the hand writing on the wall is the lampstand that was captured by Nebuchadnezzar from the temple of God in Jerusalem. And it was brought out that night from the treasury of the false god in Babylon. It was placed in the room. It was probably lit in order to help celebrate what's going on. It's like a decoration in the king's feast. And this hand is writing on the wall opposite the lampstand, which indicates this. You remember, we've studied this before. It's been a while. But in the details of the construction of the temple and the tabernacle, which is called in Scripture God's house, this structure, which was an actual, real, physical structure, but served a spiritually symbolic purpose to teach God's people some critically important principles about his relationship to his people, the way he relates to his people, the way he interacts with his people, and his purposes for them. This structure was divided into two rooms. And this is God's house. This is the way God laid out his house. The two rooms were, of course, the holy place, the main room, the big room, and then the Holy of Holies, which is a smaller room. In the Holy of Holies, we've seen this many times before, there was just only one piece of furniture, which was the Ark of the Covenant. The two rooms were divided by this thick curtain. And in the holy place, there were several items of furniture. Here, just in front of the curtain, was an altar of incense. On this, from a top-down perspective, this right wall was a table called the Table of Showbread, where fresh bread was baked and laid out every day, signifying the Lord's presence with his people. This describing what we know in the New Testament perspective as the bread of life. It was literally the bread of face, indicating God's face in close connection to his people, shining upon his people. And then opposite the bread, the Table of Showbread, was the lampstand. Which had a total of seven lamps. And those seven lamps were arranged in such a way, if we look at it from a side view, this isn't the best illustration, but you'll get the idea. It's like this, except it's straight across the top. Okay? And it looks kind of like a tree. We've seen that there's a spiritual connection between the lampstand and the tree of life. But it served practically as a lampstand, as a light source. And it's flat, all right? It's not round in this sense. It's flat in that there's one plane for all of the lights. And so that when the lamps were placed on top of the lampstand, remember the lamps had a wick coming out of them. So whichever way you turned the lamps, you would get more light pointing in that direction. So all of the lamps, we're told, were to be mounted in such a way that the lamps were to point this direction, which only makes sense. If they were pointed against the wall, then you'd be losing light in that area. But by pointing directly forward, what you had, the result of it was you had a spotlighting effect. It was like the Lord designed for a spotlight in his house to shine. Have you ever been in a nice house where someone has special lighting aimed at some special thing that they want you? They want your attention drawn to that thing as you walk in their house. Maybe a special picture on the wall, a special statue or something, some piece of art. Well, in this case, the spotlight of the lampstand shone on the Table of Showbread, highlighting the Lord's presence among his people. But this night, we're not in the temple. We're not in the tabernacle. But because of Nebuchadnezzar's conquest, the lampstand has been carried away captive along with his people. And now King Belshazzar brings out the lampstand and sets it up. And when he sins by misusing the holy vessels, and when he has all of his partygoers together in unison praise the false gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, this hand appears, disembodied, floating hand, which is kind of creepy when you think about it. Some of you aren't old enough to remember this. Did you ever see a movie, some of you older ones? There was a movie, it goes all the way back to 1960, and I saw it as a kid, and it scared the stuff out of me. It was called The Crawling Hand. Was it Peter Lorre? It was just this disconnected hand that was just crawling around, hurting people. And it was just so strange and creepy, you know, this hand. Well, this is what this king sees. Except it's not crawling around on the ground. It's floating, apparently, in midair, and it's doing something. It's writing a message. And as we learn later in the story, this is a message from God. This is a significant communication from God to specifically this king, Belshazzar. But what's interesting about this is that we're not in the temple. We're in this feast room. And we don't know exactly where he had set up the lampstand, but we do know this. There was a wall, and this hand is writing on this wall opposite the lampstand. Meaning the hand begins to write in such a way that the message is spotlighted by the lampstand. God is setting this king up to not be able to miss this message. There's a spotlight on these words. Many, many tekel parson. And so the king sees this hand, and whether or not everybody else saw the hand or not, we don't know. We do know this, that everybody else saw the writing that the hand produced. And it's possible everyone in the party saw the hand, and it's possible only the king saw the hand, but everybody did see the writing, because later when he calls for the wise men to come in and read it to him, read the message and interpret it for him, they are able to see the message. They just don't understand what the message is communicating. But the king responds to it. He has a reaction. And it's somewhat similar, only even more so, to the interesting reaction we saw King Nebuchadnezzar have to two prior messages that God spoke to him at key moments in his life. Those messages were in dreams. However, what's interesting about this is Belshazzar's not asleep. He's not dreaming. This is like a nightmare, but he's not dreaming. This is really happening in real life. And remember when King Nebuchadnezzar had his two troubling dreams, he lost sleep. He couldn't go back to sleep. He was worried. He was afraid. He didn't know what to think about these dreams and their messages. We have a similar kind of response by Belshazzar, but it's more exaggerated. This is how it's described. And the king saw, at the end of verse 5, the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed. What does that mean? It means, have you ever heard of the description, all the blood drained out of his face? You know, turned white like a ghost. Have you ever heard that description? That's what it means here. His normal, healthy, vibrant color suddenly faded in an instant. And he's white like a sheet. He is scared to death. He is totally freaked out by seeing this hand writing this message on the wall. Now, before we get into the rest of how the king responds, what I want you to notice, and we've talked about this with Nebuchadnezzar many times in our first four chapters of study, but this point is driven home once again here. What is this hand? It's not like the crawling hand in the movie, some just freakish thing. What is this hand? There's only two possibilities. It's either the hand of God himself, or it's the hand of an angel that he sent as a messenger representing him. And in either case, God certainly could make the whole being that this hand is connected to visible, but he chooses not to on purpose. He chooses to reveal only the hand of the king. Why? To freak the king out, to get his attention, to scare him to death. If he had shown him a full angel, the king's attention would have been on the angel and not on the hand and not on the message that the hand wrote. So the way the Lord revealed this to the king is a perfect way to really impact his heart. But what I want you to check out is this. What was going on just before this hand wrote? Well, from the Lord's perspective, it wasn't good, obviously. Misuse of his holy vessels, praising false gods. But from the king's perspective, what's going on? This is an important night in his life. This is where he steps to the plate and becomes the full-fledged king of Babylon. This is where he's trying to encourage the hearts of his chief governing officials for the hard days ahead in government and the future of his kingdom. And it is just an enjoyable time of a great feast and party that he's throwing. And this hand has just shown up uninvited. The king threw a party, and the hand didn't stop at the door and get its credentials checked before it entered the party. The Lord didn't ask this king, "Hey, king, I know you've got some big plans tonight, but do you mind if I make an appearance? I've got something to say." The Lord interrupts. The Lord disrupts this king's party because the Lord's purposes are far more important than the king's purposes. But this is important for us to notice because it's just an indication again. This king is not in charge of anything. Of course, yes, he's in charge of the nation of Babylon, the empire, the country that he's ruling over. But he's only there as his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar had learned through hard lessons because the Lord placed him there. He's only in that position because it's serving the Lord's good pleasure for him to be in that position. He didn't make himself king. He's not keeping himself king. This is ultimately the Lord's authority that he's holding in his hands. So the Lord doesn't mind interrupting when he needs to interrupt. The Lord is not, shy to just say, "Wait a second, this whole big party thing you've got planned here tonight, no, I'm sorry, I've got other plans, more important plans. I'm going to speak something to you tonight." And why does he need to speak tonight, this message to the king? Because before this night is over, the king is going to be dead. This is the only time he can hear this message and receive it. So the king sees the hand. The color of the king's face drains out. It says his thoughts alarmed him, which means, his mind is just going every which way, and he is wrapped up in the fearfulness of not understanding what's going on. And then very interesting description, a double description, physical description. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. Now, the last one I think we understand. And we still use this today to describe symbolically a kind of fearful thing, a fearful experience. But can you imagine being so afraid that literally your knees are doing this? That's what's going on. His knees are literally knocking together. But this description, his limbs gave way. I'm not going to get into the gory details of this, but it's a phrase that was also used to describe when you lose control of your bodily functions and soil yourself. That's how frightened the king was. One moment, he's totally in charge of life, living large and in charge. The next moment, his life is virtually over, and it just about is literally over. He just doesn't fully understand that yet. And it's all because the Lord has given him a message and given it to him in a way that strikes fear into his heart purposefully and intentionally. Now, we understand this, that God has a purpose for his people to not live in fear. God does not want us to live afraid. He does not want us to live in fear. But that does not mean, and biblically we see many examples of this, that God never uses fear as a tool to reach the heart of a hard-hearted and unrepentant individual. Sometimes someone whose heart is so hard they will not listen to anything else can only be reached through stirring their hearts with fear. And that's what the Lord does in this circumstance. All right, so the king has an extreme reaction. Now, one of the other things that we should notice from this, I was mentioning about God being in charge and God's sovereignty. We see from this example that all of the interactions that God had with Nebuchadnezzar to demonstrate to Nebuchadnezzar that the Lord was in charge and Nebuchadnezzar wasn't ultimately in charge, we're not to limit that just to a special relationship between God and Nebuchadnezzar. This is now a subsequent generation. This is a different king. This is a different interaction between God and a different man altogether. And what we're meant to learn from this is God wasn't just in charge of Babylon during the moments of Nebuchadnezzar's life. God remains here 40 years later in charge of the king of Babylon and the empire of Babylon, though the king is not at this moment acknowledging it. Now, the king is perplexed. He's alarmed. So what does he do? He makes the same mistake that Nebuchadnezzar made. But it's part of the telling of the story for our benefit. What did Nebuchadnezzar do when he woke up from his two troubling dreams? He immediately called for all the wise men of his kingdom, all of the royal counselors, this special category of men that were set apart just to study and learn and to grow in the wisdom of Babylon. He calls for them all to come and explain his dreams to him. And in both cases, they weren't able to explain his dreams. They didn't understand what it was that he dreamed and what it meant, what the message in the dreams was. And the king had to call for, in both earlier cases, Daniel to come and explain the dreams to him. And of course, God gave to Daniel not just understanding of what the dreams meant, but even understanding of what the king had actually dreamed. And in one case, even gave Daniel a vision of the actual dream of the king. So in this case, we see Belshazzar, alarmed, troubled, afraid, worried, fearful, and he does the same thing that his grandfather had done. He calls for all the wise men of Babylon to come. But again, Daniel's not among their number. And apparently, in the intervening years, because remember the last we saw at the end of chapter 4, Daniel has finally reached a position of great respect in the eyes of King Nebuchadnezzar. He finally gets who Daniel really is, how wise Daniel is. He finally gets that Daniel has a special connection to the Lord. And he places Daniel as chief of all of the categories of the wise men of Babylon. He's in charge of them. But now we're years down the line, nearly a generation later, and at this point, Daniel is apparently no longer chief of the wise men of Babylon. Somewhere in the intervening years between King Nebuchadnezzar, the three kings that followed him, then the fourth king, Nabonidus, and then his son, Belshazzar, Daniel's kind of been shoved into the background. The subsequent kings have lost the perspective of the value of this special servant, Daniel. It's kind of like in the story of Joseph. And we're told that, you know, after Joseph died, that in the realm of Egypt, that a later Pharaoh arose who didn't know Joseph and didn't value him and didn't respect him, and later enslaved the Israelites who descended from Joseph and his family because they had lost that value. Same thing is going on here. And so the king is stuck. His counselors can't help him. They don't have the answer. They see the message that's written on the wall, but they don't get it. They don't understand it. They don't know how to interpret it. And he doesn't know anything about Daniel. And so where is he going to turn? And this is where the Lord intervenes through another person that's introduced into the story. Let's read in verse 10. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall. And the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And she's describing Daniel here, and she goes on from here to give a wonderful, it's an awesome description of Daniel. Now, who is this queen? There are some who mistakenly identify her as one of the wives of Belshazzar. This is not one of the wives of Belshazzar. We know this for certain because back up in the beginning of the story in verse 2, it says, Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. All of the women that he had that kind of relationship with were with him in the feast. This queen was not at the feast. She comes in later. Who is this queen? Most likely, this is what is called in ancient political terms, the queen mother. You ever heard this term before? The queen mother is the queen, but she's not married to the king. She's the mother of the king. And she has the official and royal title of queen. This was probably the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar and the mother of Belshazzar. If she truly was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, she was most likely around at the time of the events in which Daniel was brought in and gave the correct answers to the king, King Nebuchadnezzar, to resolve the mystery of the spiritual dreams that he had and the messages from God that were contained in those dreams. She certainly remembers enough about those events, whether she was there to personally witness them or whether her father told her later the testimony after he was saved, as we saw at the end of chapter 4. But this is what she says about Daniel. There is a man in your kingdom. The implication is, how many men in the king's kingdom will be able to resolve the mystery of this message? There's one and one only, and it happens to be Daniel. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, this is referring to Nebuchadnezzar, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers. Because an excellent spirit, we're talking here about, that's another way of describing what we call high character. That his character is of such purity and of such integrity that it's noticeable in all of the interactions that he has with people around him in the court of the king. Because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. I love her confidence. She's seen him work. She knows. This, if anyone's got the answer, this man's got the answer. Call for him. He will tell you the answer. And she may not fully understand who the Lord is, and the Lord being the true source of all of these wonderful qualities that she describes in Daniel, but she certainly, if she doesn't understand the heart of Daniel's relationship with the Lord, she understands the fruit of his relationship with the Lord. She's seen Daniel in action day after day after day. Daniel's not a young man anymore. At the beginning of the book of Daniel, at the beginning of the story, at the beginning of his interactions with Nebuchadnezzar, we identify that Daniel was somewhere between the age, young man, somewhere between 15 and 20 years old. By the time of this story, he's closer to 80 years old now. It's a long time that he's lived this life. And there's not one bad thing that she can remember of him. She remembers only wonderful qualities, good testimony. It's an excellent description to us of the way, if we were to live in a manner that's fully pleasing to the Lord, the way we are meant to impact the lives of other people around us. I mean, wouldn't you want, if you had an interaction with someone 60 years ago, and this is what they took away as the memory, and all they've ever heard of you ever since then has left this crystal clear memory in their heart and mind, and they give this testimony about you. This isn't your own lips saying, oh, I am so knowledgeable, I'm so wise, I'm so this, I'm so that, I have such an excellent spirit. Daniel never has to say any of those things about himself, and of course, it would be inappropriate for him to do so. But the scripture tells us, let the lips of another praise you and not you yourself. And that's what the Lord does. He has this queen, this mother of the king, share this wonderful testimony of the excellence of Daniel's character, his track record, the fruit of his heart and relationship and service to the Lord. And so she shares this with the king. The king is duly impressed. He is, of course, a desperate man at this point. None of his counselors have been able to satisfy his need. And so what does he do? He has him brought in verse 13 before him. And the king answered and said to Daniel, you are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah. Now, it's not immediately apparent by the simple description that's given here, but this is really a one-upsmanship that the king is doing with Daniel. He's basically putting Daniel in his place. He's referring to Daniel as a captive, a slave, a servant. Now, Daniel was all that because he still remained to this day a captive to the Empire of Babylon until the Lord was to later release the children of Israel under the rule of Cyrus, which we'll see later in the book of Daniel. But Daniel is no mere exile. He's no mere captive. The first four chapters tell us of his long and wonderful service to the king. The queen mother herself just described to the king who he was. And did the queen mother in any of her description describe him as a captive, as an exile? She only said wonderful things about him, about what a great and wise and marvelous servant of the king he was. And her description, the only description she really gives of him, is your father, the king, made him chief over all of the wise men. That's a highest level governing official. He doesn't refer to him, oh, you're that Daniel, you're the former chief of all of the wise men. He refers to him, you're that Daniel, the exile, to kind of put Daniel in his place to start this conversation. We're going to see next week when we get into the exchange between Daniel and the king. Daniel doesn't, I don't think, really appreciate the way the king speaks to him. And I don't think Daniel appreciates the way the king is thinking of the Lord and his place in relationship to the Lord either. We're going to see Daniel is going to share with him some very heart-cutting responses in our study next week. But anyway, just to understand, that's where the king is coming from. You're that Daniel, the exile, whom my father brought from Judah. And he says two things about him. I have heard of you, that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding, excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show me the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretation and solve problems. So he heard two things that he held on to. I've heard of you. And I've heard that you can do certain things. The king is approaching Daniel from a completely utilitarian perspective. Look, I got a problem. I've heard you're the problem solver. So, you know, solve this problem for me. And he makes a generous offer to Daniel. He offers, if you will tell me what this message that was written by this hand on my wall means, if you'll read it and explain it to me, interpret it for me, I'll do three things for you. I'll clothe you in a purple robe. That was a symbolic robe of great dignity and authority. Only royalty was allowed to wear purple robes in the king of Babylon, in the kingdom of Babylon. So it was really basically saying, I'm gonna give you an honor that no one besides myself and my father has received. And I will put a gold chain around your neck. That was also symbolic. Even though gold was commonplace in Babylon, this particular kind of gold chain was a symbol of royal authority. Only the kings were allowed to wear them. So he's basically saying, I'm going to clothe you in two of the most visible symbols of royalty. And I will make you ruler over a third of the kingdom. What that means is there's two ways to interpret that. It could mean what I'm going to do is I'm going to split Babylon into three slices of pie, and I'll put you in charge of one of those three slices. But the better way to understand what he's saying to him is, look, in Babylon, there right now are two kings. I will make you third king of the kingdom. First king is my father. Second king is me. Third king is you. If you'll answer this riddle, if you'll describe it to me, I will make you in charge of everything except me and my father. You will have authority over everyone and everything, only under our authority alone. Very similar kind of offer that in a prior generation Pharaoh had made to Joseph. And it's very, very generous to make this, as he just described him, exile, captive, slave, king, essentially, over the entire empire, if you will resolve this one troubling riddle that has just shaken me to my core. All right, I will stop there tonight, and next week, Lord willing, we'll pick up in verse 17 with Daniel's response to the king, his full explanation, and then the events that lead up to the very final moments of King Belshazzar's life, which is to end that very night. God bless you, and look forward to seeing you Sunday.